You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to SpyCast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, SpyCast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about SpyCast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make SpyCast better, and you can help. So we're joined today by Meredith Henley, who's a writer and historian who lives here in Washington, D.C. Her work has appeared in Humanities, New York Times, Washington Post, Salon, Daily Beast, Christian Science Monitor, Longreads, Barnes & Noble Review, and others. Currently, she is senior writer for Humanities, the quarterly review of the National Endowment for the Humanities, which as of today still exists, so we're happy about that. And she is the author of Destination Casablanca, Exile, Espionage, and the Battle for North Africa in World War II. Welcome to SpyCast, and thank you for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you for having me.
So I always like to ask authors, historians especially, of writing about intelligence, kind of where the idea for the books come from, because World War II is a massive war, and people have written a lot about it, but the intelligence side hasn't been done all that well. You're kind of taking a very specific location and kind of a niche part of the war, North Africa. Usually when you hear North Africa in World War II, talking about Rommel and the desert, but this is a smaller story, but it has broad implications. So where in the world did this idea come from for this book?
Well, it may not surprise you to hear it came actually from the movie. Like everyone, I've seen the movie. I saw it in high school. And even then, I was interested in the questions of why is the French resistance in North Africa? Why are they in Casablanca? What are the refugees doing there? What is this whole notion of papers and spies? And that kind of stuck with me. And every time I would see the movie, I, you know, would have those same questions over and over. It's that sort of historian brain kicks in.
Right.
And but then when I was doing research for my dissertation, I, you know, you start spinning microfilm and looking through documents and you're looking for very specific things. But as I was, you know, on the hunt, I would see mentions of Casablanca and refugees and Casablanca and internment camps, and then also other things coming in and OSS records from Casablanca. And I kind of filed that away because you can't always go after the shiny thing
right.
at that moment. And so when I was looking to write a book, I remembered those documents and I remembered those questions, and I went back and looked and I thought, what really is going on here? What is the story of Casablanca during the war?
Well, this is amazing. I mean, this is one of the most popular movies ever made, and the fact that no one has sat down and said, let me do the history of this period from this perspective. That's kind of the holy grail. It's like, what do you mean no one's done this? That's wonderful.
I know why they haven't done it now.
Well, I mean, it's obviously not easy to do. This was, you know, for anyone checking out this book, their first reaction may be, wow, that's a big book. Because, you know, there's so many moving parts in this. And I want to ask you a little bit about research, because anytime you're writing history, research is problematic, but intelligence history especially so, because none of these documents were written for us. You know, sometimes they're written for everything from cover your ass to disinformation, everything in between, and redaction, all that, all the problems associated with doing about intelligence history. So let's talk a little bit about the research. I mean, you talk a little bit about how you saw bits and pieces of it while you're researching your dissertation, but how do you start a research project like this? Do you dive right in at a certain point, or you pick pieces away from the periphery?
I started picking pieces off. And I started with, you know, record groups. So it was State Department, the Consulate Records, RG84, amazing trove of information, both about what's going on in the city, but also politics. And then there are lots of glimmers of spies in those records, because it's when they show up at the consulate, there's a record of that. When they have to get a new passport, there's a record of that. When they need more office space, there's a record of that. When they have to requisition more office space, there's a record. So that was sort of provided glimpses. And then, of course, I dove into OSS records, which are kind of a mess.
Not kind of a mess. They're a complete mess.
They're a total mess. But I dove into those, and then I started triangulating back from that. The records for OSS aren't as good for Casablanca as they are for other places. But I was sort of able to triangulate. I used those, and then I used, you know, standard State Department. I got really lucky because OSS did a oral history called the Torch Anthology, which they did right after, not too long after Torch, because Donovan was trying to have this record of OSS's contribution to the war and to Torch. And so they sat down with all of the OSS agents and interviewed them about what they did in the run-up to Torch. And it's really useful, not just because it's a kind of oral history, but because there are people commenting on what the answers are. Mm. And so they'll actually disagree, and they'll be like, well, that's not really quite what happened, or he's being very modest here. He really did X, Y, and Z. And so essentially it becomes a process of triangulation. Personal papers were also really important. Dave King and Stafford Reed, their personal papers were out at Hoover Institution. There were lots of glimmers of what was going on in those. Same with Robert Murphy's papers are also out there. Stafford Reed also wrote a memoir, and there are two copies. One he wrote, the copy is actually at the National Archives, and he wrote it because he was brought back to Casablanca in 43, from Casablanca to D.C. in 43, and they did it, gave him a medical exam and discovered he had a heart murmur. So they didn't want to send him back out in the field, and he was angry because he thought, this is ridiculous. I've been on assignment and did perfectly fine. So he, one of the ways he channeled his anger was to write sort of a memoir of what he did. So there's that copy, but there's also another copy out at Hoover, which he kind of polished up and was hoping to publish. And they're very interesting in terms of what's in one and what's in not, and how the criticisms kind of get shaved off a little bit in the more sort of the one he was hoping to publish. The one in the National Archives is pretty raw, which is really helpful too.
Right. I mean, that's the greatest thing there is the kind of, not only is it immediate after what had happened, so it's not like it's been whitewashed through either his brain or kind of editing. Right. You know, but you're getting the real feelings at the time, instead of it being kind of, you know, produced and manufactured through the process to create something that people might want to read someday.
Right. And one of the other things that was really helpful was to Gordon Howe, who wrote Northwest Africa for the Army Green Book series. His documentation for that book is also available. It's in the National Archives, and he interviewed everybody trying to track down facts. And if you go through the correspondence for that, there's all kinds of interesting tidbits. And he was nailing down a lot of the questions that I had, trying to figure out who was doing what where, and that was really helpful too. He also interviewed all of these guys as well.
Let's talk a little bit about the importance of Casablanca, you know, in a micro sense, but also North Africa writ large. You know, there's a lot of people don't, it's a kind of a footnote to the war, looking at it in hindsight, right? You look at the invasion of Europe and then the island hopping campaign in the Pacific and the atomic bombing in the Pacific. This kind of North African campaign is seen as almost, for tank people, it's great because you have Rommel and everybody.
Woo-hoo!
But for the most part, it's secondary, even tertiary to the World War II story. But there's pretty important reasons that they go to North Africa in the first place.
There are a lot of important reasons they go to North Africa, but let's start with the Casablanca. Which was kind of a minor port city on the coast of the Atlantic until the 20th century, when the French took over the Kingdom of Morocco. In the Treaty of Fez in 1912, carved Morocco up. So the northern one-fourth went to Spain, and it was called Spanish Morocco. Tangier became an international free trade zone, free city. And then the southern three-fourths became the French protectorate of Morocco. And the French like every other colony, they came to basically exploit it economically. And they were very unhappy with the Treaty of Fez because they really wanted Tangier, which was the jewel. It was the port. It's on the Atlantic. It's right across from Gibraltar. But the French said, okay, we can't have Tangier. We'll just turn Casablanca into the largest port on the Atlantic. And so it becomes, in 1916, it's a town of 67,000 people. By 1940, it's a town of 350,000, and it is the economic hub of the country now. And it's really important because it has modern port facilities. There are rail lines that go in. And when the Eisenhower and Patton and everybody at AFHQ in London started looking at North Africa, they realized that Casablanca could be a very good opportunity in terms of logistics because they could turn it into a logistical hub. You sail American ships across the Atlantic, they dock at Casablanca, then you can use the rail lines to send supplies up to Algiers. You don't have to worry about going through the Straits of Gibraltar. Mm-hmm. Also, if you take Morocco, there's a nice concrete airstrip up at Port Laoute, which will also be incredibly important. So that, in that sense, Casablanca is important for that reason.
The converse is also true that if the Germans are able to capture this area, they have a massive port facility that can straight shot to the United States, airfields, naval, you know,
and in fact,
bases.
Hitler actually makes a play for the air bases in Casablanca. He makes a play for Morocco shortly after the creation of Vichy and ends up backing down and decides to basically focus on Britain and Russia instead. And but he definitely had designs on Casablanca and on Morocco because it was a jumping off point to the United States. So everyone sort of looks at the map and sees it has possibilities.
Well, North Africa, in a broader sense, was pretty important for the British / allies to maintain it because the ability of the Germans to cut off the Mediterranean would have been essentially a death sentence for all of the British Empire, you know, access to the Suez. But also, you know, for anyone who knows the basic plan of the Allies in World War II is the invasion from the south into Sicily. And then Italy was required first conquering North Africa.
So the idea is that if the Allies go to North Africa, they can use it as a springboard. They can go to southern France, they go to Italy, they go to Greece, Sicily. And it's a way to get to Europe without necessarily having to do the cross-channel invasion, which they weren't ready to do, and they wouldn't be ready to do until 1944. North Africa is still hard. It's a hard campaign. It wasn't guaranteed that it would work, but it also had other advantages in that it kind of gave a really green, particularly the Americans, a really green fighting force a chance to find their feet. Mm-hmm. Now, they would stumble when they got to Tunisia a bit, but, you know, the invasion of Morocco and Algiers, Morocco in particular, is a very successful amphibious invasion. It's the first one of the war for the Americans.
Let me ask a little bit. You brought up Vichy government. there's a lot of politics involved. Once Vichy becomes the government, you know, just the basic background for anyone out there that doesn't understand is when the Germans invaded France in 1940. A lot of the French capitulated and they became some a puppet state in southern France called Vichy, because that's where the government moved to. But even though there are those that were considered collaborators with the Germans, there was a lot of internal politics within the Vichy government where people like making jokes about the French, but there were people who really only pretended to be capitulating to the Germans, mm-hmm. but kind of kept up the ruse from the outside. So some of the big arguments, and you talk about these a lot in the book, is how do you keep the Vichy government from giving French North Africa just straight to the Germans?
Right.
Handing it over, right, as part of the deal. And how to keep the French from using North African resources to help reinforce the German war effort. Because, you know, North Africa is wanted because of resources.
Yes.
You know, everything from the road to the Middle East to natural resources in North Africa itself. You know, can you talk a little about the politics that within Vichy, like forget the outside, but just within the kind of leadership of trying to maintain that balance?
So there's the Vichy politics are really, they're incredibly complicated. At one point, I actually had essentially a murder board set up because it was musical, people change positions so often in musical chairs. But obviously, at the head is Philippe Pétain, who is a World War I hero. He's the hero of Verdun, and he is who everyone reveres, and everything in Vichy revolves around him. And then there's like sort of cast of characters. There's Darlan and others who, and Weygand, they are also in it for their own devices as well. And Darlan is definitely a full-on collaborator. Weygand, Maxime Weygand, who is a French army general, he is not. And he understands that Vichy has, he helped birth Vichy, but then he wasn't too keen on collaborating with the Germans, and he gets in, and that sort of gets him into trouble. And one of to rather than just fire him, Pétain creates a new position called the High Commissioner of North Africa and sends Weygand to North Africa with the idea that he could sort of mine North Africa, which Pétain, it was very important to Pétain and the others who created Vichy. They, if the Germans had insisted that they give up the French colonies in North Africa, they would not have signed the armistice. They were so important to them, both in sort of their mind, but also economically. So they send Weygand off to North Africa. He's very grumpy, but he gets there and he tries to make most of the job. And that creates an opening for a few people to think that maybe he could be dealt with, he could be brought onto the American side, particularly Franklin Roosevelt thinks that Weygand maybe isn't a collaborator and he could be dealt with.
Well, and these are all incredibly strong personalities.
Yes.
I mean, you talk about Pétain and Weygand and Girard and Darlan, and then we haven't even brought up Charles de Gaulle yet.
No,
you know, who becomes
the
part of this
strong
story.
Personality.
You know, I mean, there's a cult of personality in France surrounding Pétain, you know, from World War One. And these leaders don't get along with each other. I mean,
they don't, to
the point where some of them actually want to like execute the others for collaboration and other like that too. And it, what plays out is an interesting tug of war between those who have colluded and those who resisted, and then how that flips. You brought up Darlan was a full fledged collaborator until it was time for him not to be.
Right.
And you know, and you kind of see this where even the lower level leadership in Casablanca. You know, that's where the whole roundup, the usual suspects comes from. It's like, we're not actually going to do the real job here. We're going to just do what we can to placate the Germans. And even things like cooking the books on troop numbers to slowly reacting when the United States finally arrives to send in reinforcements. This is tricky for the people on the ground. Now I'm like bringing it down to kind of the French bureaucrats on the ground because one misstep and you get the Gestapo on top of you. You get the, you know, the full weight of the German machine cracking down. And not only that, on a bigger scale, and I'll let you talk after
this. Okay.
On a bigger scale, you could entice the Germans to go, well, the Vichy can't control this area. We're going to do it ourselves and actually invade.
Which is what, I mean, fear of invasion, fear of the Germans invading North Africa is really what led a lot of people in French Morocco to continue to work with the Vichy regime. That's definitely the case for the resident general, Charles Nogues, who is he's a World War I veteran. He's a veteran of the Rif campaign in Morocco. He loves Morocco. He thought he wanted the French to continue fighting from North Africa, to continue the fight, to not give in. But when that was clear it wasn't going to happen, he decided that he would do what he could to keep Morocco from the Germans. And I find him to be one of the more interesting characters in the book because you can see him make a series of small and sometimes large accommodations with himself and his sort of moral compass to the point where he gets to be a full-fledged collaborator by the end and is considered to be that. But there are other, on the ground, you also, people continue to work for the regime. The governor of Casablanca, a man named Contard, was actually relieved of his duties because he wasn't considered to be Vichy enough. Mm-hmm. He's replaced with a absolute apricotchnik. But at the same time, you got people like Colonel Maurice Harbeau, who is the head of the Securité in Casablanca, who works with the Resistance and with Dave King. And you get that, and you get Albert Breitel, who is the head of counterintelligence, who also works with OSS. And then you get people like Antoine Bethuart, who is the head of the Casablanca division, who keeps the Americans and OSS at a distance until it's clear that they're coming, and then he tries to convince Nogues to throw in his lot with the Allies and to not fight. And that doesn't turn out so well for him.
Because we'll be right back after this.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Sixsense. Sixsense provides award-winning cloud-based automated endpoint and vulnerability management solutions to streamline IT and security operations. With its advanced platform, businesses gain complete visibility and control over their infrastructure, reducing IT and security risks and optimizing operational efficiency. With Sixsense, you'll get real-time alerts, risk-based vulnerability prioritization and remediations, and an intuitive automation and orchestration engine so you can focus on your core business goals, confident in the knowledge that your enterprise is secure, compliant, and running smoothly. To learn why enterprises choose Sixsense, visit sixsense.com.
Yeah, I mean, there are interesting external politics here, too, because the British become even more an enemy to the French in North Africa than even the Germans are, yes, in certain cases. And that's because of the destruction of the French fleet and other things, right, like that, too. And so when the Americans get involved, even at the lower levels of the OSS, but then later on with a full-fledged military assault, right, the role of the British has to be kept, you know, like hide somewhere. Even though you're involved, don't let them see that you're involved, right, because the hatred of the British for the French, I mean, that goes back centuries, certainly, but it's really...
Mirz al-Kabir, though.
Yeah.
And it really does inflame. Like, so when the British sink the French fleet at Mirz al-Kabir, it just really galvanizes hatred for them in North Africa. And it's right. I mean, the Western Task Force that invades French Morocco, there are no Brits, and it's intentional because they worry that if the Brits do show up, then the French really will fight. And what they would like them to do is not fight.
Right.
But that doesn't, you know, they still end up fighting. There are some Brits, obviously, the British forces that come ashore with Algiers. But the British, the British element is definitely, that sort of element's definitely a problem. But it also, I mean, in some ways, it creates an opportunity for the Americans in French Morocco because after Mirz al-Kabir, the British consulate packs up and has to leave, and they seal up the embassy in Tangier. I'm sorry, that's not true. Tangier embassy stays open. But they seal up Casablanca, and they're basically burning their codes, they're burning the files, and they're running out of the country before they get arrested. And that means that the Americans then absorb all British affairs. And so all roads in Casablanca start to lead to the American consulate. And the American consulate becomes really one of the few games in town, mm-hmm, for both refugees, but also it becomes a big, you know, spy hub.
Right. Well, let's talk about some of the personalities that are, sure, notable in this book. And the one that truly stands out is Josephine Baker, who people may know of as an entertainer, but some know that she was also a very effective intelligence officer. I'm using that word on purpose. She was basically a pro by the time she got around to later in the war. And her war really begins with the invasion of France. I mean, the idea, well, even, right, before, you even could before, say that when France joins the war but hasn't been quite invaded yet, she used her position to help the French intelligence to identify, I guess, Nazi sympathizers, probably, right, the right word, you know, for a fifth column inside, right, France.
She's a great example of someone who's a good spy, but you wouldn't think they would be,
yeah,
in part because everybody wants to talk to Josephine Baker and they want to impress her. And so they tell her things and she can chat up anybody and she can go anywhere and doors just open for her. And so she collects intelligence and she would write down information on her arm at parties and then to bring it back so she would remember what it was. And her handler, who, a man by the name of Jacques Abbé, just feared for her that she would get caught, that she would jeopardize herself for it. But she's very much committed, and she also understands, particularly once with the advent of Vichy, that if she is caught, she'll be arrested, and she will be made an example of. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, some of the tradecraft involved right. using secret writing on the sheet music to pinning stuff inside her clothes, but she knew right. she wouldn't be searched
right,
to that level.
Who is going to search Madame Baker? It's you know, so when she comes to, she leaves Vichy and she ends up in Morocco. And the idea is, and she's sent there by French intelligence and free French intelligence. And the idea is that she, because of who she is, she has more freedom to go places than mm-hmm. other people. It's easier for her to get visas. It's easier for her to make arrangements. And that is definitely the case. She flits around between Portugal and Spain. And while she's there, she collects information and she writes it on invisible ink on the back of sheet music.
Well, and she's going to parties and she's going to functions and just everybody's yeah. talking to her. I mean, perfect.
It's perfect. But then she has a health crisis. And she ends up stuck in a Casablanca clinic for a year and a half. And even then, she's still spying because her hospital room becomes a place where everybody wants to come because everybody wants to pay their respects to Madame Baker to make sure that she's fine. Does she need anything? Is she doing well? And so it becomes a gathering place, and they just collect intelligence from that. And I actually got an email from a woman who grew up in Casablanca, and she said her mother had the room next to Josephine Baker in the clinic. And she could hear her saying, Jacques, Jacques, you know, down the hall. So definitely, even then, she's, you know, even if she's ill and very, very ill, she's still, you know, doing her part.
Well, and as she was up and moving at certain points, kind of the perfect cover for the people with her.
Right.
Because you could essentially be invisible if you're walking around with Joe Baker because no one's paying attention to you.
No.
They're paying attention to her.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that was an interesting part. You know, I guess the professional intelligence officer who was her
handler/lover.
Yes. I'm trying to figure out the way to put that.
No, he and she are pretty explicit about that.
Well, and the worry he had was like, would he be rounded up? And then he realized that no one was paying any attention to him. It was all her, and he essentially was invisible as he moved through. Mm-hmm. That's about as good as it gets when you're trying to blend in. You've already mentioned Dave King and Staff Reed. That, to me, they're interesting because they're the first to provide any kind of intelligence from this area of the world. I mean, for decades, U.S. intelligence had depended on the British and the French for mm-hmm. information yeah. about North Africa. And, you know, we after 9/11, everyone kind of freaked out about the fact that we had a bunch of Russian speakers at CIA and no one spoke Arabic right. and very few people spoke Pashto or anything else. There was no Arabic speakers for U.S. intelligence nope. prior to World War II.
They went looking in military intelligence, and there were none. So it's North Africa. It's mostly, it's also, you know, French is the second tier language. The French are also in charge. So they started looking for French speakers. And King and Reed had both sort of volunteered their services in different ways. They'd mentioned to Army intelligence that they would be interested in doing something. And both had been in Army intelligence in World War I. So they had some ties. King also had something else that would help him a great deal as he worked in Casablanca, which was he had also joined the French Foreign Legion. Mm-hmm. He left Harvard when World War I started, and he signed up with the French Foreign Legion, and he went and fought in France. And so that gave him an in, because the French Foreign Legion is incredibly important mm-hmm. in North Africa. So he had an in with all of the sort of the French officer corps in Casablanca, and it gave him a little more cachet. But neither one of them, even though they both would sort of transition from to intelligence during the war, neither one of them were experts in the region. And in fact, when they were looking, they just couldn't find anybody. And they just rounded up people who spoke French and seemed to be sort of capable and maybe good at a cocktail party. You know?
Well, there's always a trick because you never knew the you know, who you're dealing with, whether or not they were loyal to right. France proper or to Vichy, or right. had some leanings toward the Germans. And kind of, it's tricky to find people to recruit because one misstep, and then all of a sudden, you've attracted the attention of a very heavy presence of the Gestapo down right. in Casablanca in North Africa.
And they were watched constantly. They had tails. They were, I mean, every movement was observed. They developed a phones or tap. They actually developed a way of communicating on phones. It involved a lot of American slang that would confuse both the French and the Germans, just to sort of mix things up.
Well, and their cover was there was an agreement, an economic agreement,
right,
between the United States, which hadn't joined the war yet, and in Vichy France and North Africa to send supplies. And so they were sent down to be supply inspectors.
Yes.
Which put them in a position to talk to just about everybody.
It's great cover because the idea as part of the agreement was that the British really weren't keen on the agreement because they worried that sending supplies into North Africa would break the blockade. But they said, okay, fine, if we have to do this, and this is a way to sort of keep relations open with Vichy, they're going to be, you know, inspectors. So they end up with 12 initially, and they're jokingly called the apostles because of 12. And they become vice consuls. Originally, they were going to send them over in uniform, and then someone realized that if they went to war, then they could be shot. Yeah. So they decided they would send them over as, you know, members of the State Department instead, which had other problems associated with it. So they come, and the idea is that they're going to inspect the shipments. And when the shipments come in, the idea is they go into the good state in French Morocco rather than being reshipped up to France and then on to Germany. But if you're inspecting shipments, that means you have to go down to the port, which means you get to note what ships are in dock. And is the Jean Bart, which is a battleship that's in Casablanca's harbor and is... needs a lot of work on it. You can note how well that's going, mm-hmm. and whether or not the turret is now functioning. They got to know everybody down at the port. And then also because of that work at the port, it opened up other doors in the city, which would allow them to develop an intelligence network.
Well, and because of their ability to move around as diplomats, they can inspect bridges and railroads and kind of all the things that you would need to know. You know, how to cut off utilities if you needed to, and fortifications and everything that would go into prepping for an eventual invasion.
They became great. I mean, they actually collected, they would get a list and they collected the order of battle for Morocco. They noted all the bridges. What does the coastline look like? They had contacts with all the public service utilities. They practiced low-level sabotage. It's kind of extraordinary what they were able to accomplish, given that they weren't really trained in spycraft in the way that we would think, you know, that spies are conventionally trained today.
Well, once the United States joins the war and the decision for torch was made, and you do a really good job, and I'm going to skip it, talking about the back and forth deliberations between North Africa and Europe and everywhere else.
The transatlantic essay contest between Roosevelt and Churchill.
With Stalin throwing in a little bit.
As Eisenhower, throw some serious shade on them for that.
When the OSS is created, a man named William Eddy, is that how you pronounce his name, or Eddy?
I think it's Eddy. Eddy arrives before OSS, though.
Okay. So, right. So Donovan hand chose him.
After Pearl Harbor.
Right, but when he was coordinator of information, not quite OSS director yet.
This is also a great case of the evolution of American intelligence during the war, where we go from North Africa, from our spies being vice consul, to them being absorbed by Donovan and the coordinator of information, to then being OSS. And it's sort of a... kind of nice little flow chart, as it were, of how we go from infantile to, a little more toddler stage, maybe.
Well, I mean, Eddie's an intelligence officer, and he actually has some necessary skill sets
for
working
great.
In that area of the world. I mean, he actually does speak Arabic.
Yes.
He has some experience in that area of the world
He's a great... I quite like him, in part because I'll admit, as the historian, he writes really good letters. And which is always good. But he grew up in Syria. He's a child of missionaries, speaks Arabic. But then he also had a PhD in English Lit and had been the president of Hobart College. And he's another one who, when the war comes along, resigns and joins the fight. And he gets handpicked by Donovan. And they set him up in Tangier with the idea that he would basically coordinate intelligence activities both in Morocco and in Algeria. And so they get a suite of rooms at the American legation in Tangier to set up a sort of a spy shop operation. But he has a difficult time in Tangier too. A couple people try and blow up his car. They're followed around all the time by Nazi agents. But he actually, of all of them, he is the one person who, you know, sort of had the resume to do the job.
Well, I mean, you can see the dramatic difference. You tell an anecdote mm-hmm. in the story of how Reed and one other man, I'm trying to remember the name, Holcomb, mm-hmm. was that it? Freaked out because there's a celebration including yes. gunfire going on. And
it's for Ramadan.
And yeah, Eddie's like, Ramadan. It's and they're Ramadan. Like, what is that? What I'm is like, it? Dude, you're operating in a predominantly Muslim area, and you have been for a while, and you've never heard of Ramadan before.
Well, I mean, Reed hadn't even heard the call to prayer until they, you know, they land in Tangier for the first night, and he's like, what is that? So that was just a lack of experience with the region.
So you're kind of starting to see the professionalization a yes. little bit as we move along, and it's just in time because the initial fight for North Africa, I think people don't quite understand, number one, it wasn't just landing a bunch of troops on the beach. There's a massive naval battle.
Yes.
And I love this, you know, trivia-wise, this, you know, the largest naval battle in the Atlantic was between the United States and the French.
The French.
Yeah. I mean, right. that to me, a kind of great little, never
French,
thought that way.
The French didn't do so well.
No, not so much.
I mean, they get decimated. So the first day of fighting, the naval battle actually goes on for 2 days. But Admiral Michelet, who is in charge of the Casablanca base, would call the harbor a cemetery by the time the Americans were done. The Americans sustain a little bit of damage to one ship, but the French, I mean, what's left of the fleet is at the bottom of Casablanca harbor or beached.
Yeah, no, I mean, in the USS Massachusetts, the battleship, which you can actually go on and yeah. up in Falls River, Massachusetts, it's not very fair. That ship by itself was more modern and powerful than essentially the entire French fleet, and it was joined by an entire task force
yes.
of U.S. Navy. And, you know, the Army took a, you know, Kazarine Pass and others were a bit of a learning pains the hard way for the U.S. Army, but the Navy kind of knew what the hell they were doing, and they certainly showed it at the battle with the French.
They did. They definitely successful. And also Hewitt gets a lot of credit, Admiral Kent Hewitt, for how he would deploy the ships. But I also want to give Hewitt credit for how he got the fleet across the Atlantic, because I think that it's one of the more extraordinary parts of the story, in that we have this invasion, we have this task force of 101 ships, and they leave from 5 different points along the Atlantic seaboard in the Caribbean, and they meet up in the Atlantic, and they form a convoy that is 20 miles by 30 miles wide. And they managed to make it all the way across the Atlantic without being detected,
right.
which is extraordinary if we think about today and the fact that everything is, you know, observed by spy satellite and in communications and intercepts.
But even at the time is extraordinary because you have the submarine force of the Germans
right.
spread out through the Atlantic and not a single one right. was able to report back that there's this massive...
They would chase them away yeah. and they would, you know, conduct ops to sort of draw them away, but they still managed to make it off the coast, and it's a complete surprise.
And it's not like you're not bringing with you some interesting personalities in your task force, because...
Are you talking about Patton?
Well, and everybody else, but certainly, you know, Mark Clark and George
yes.
Patton and others that are just kind of awe of the capabilities of the Navy, which you don't normally see.
No, Patton actually, yeah. it's surprising. He's quite charmed by Hewitt. I think I have a feeling there was some really great drinking going on the yeah. ship at various times. But he's very impressed by the job that they do and the work that they do and how they deliver his men, and they deliver them on time. I mean, there's like, even before they take off, there's a whole thing about like whether or not the Navy will actually get us there when they're supposed to. But they do, and on time, and then they give them the backup firepower that they need.
I was pleasantly surprised by the book because it... Oh. I shouldn't have been. I knew it should have been. You know, it was good coming in, but the kind of thematic changes that take place through this book make it always interesting. Because for a good chunk of the book, you're going through personalities, and I'm looking up French names because I don't know these guys very well and other things. But there's a lot of politics, a lot of background. Then about halfway through, it switches to a full-fledged, to me, a book about intelligence history with Mark Clark coming up on the beach from the submarine
right.
and doing and all that. And then there's a dramatic transition, and it's done very well, to a military history. Once you start discussing the battle, and that's done very well, and it's not always easy to do, you know, but
you.
All of a sudden I'm like, this should got it. I mean, I've read enough military histories of World War II, and I assume you have too, to be able to pull it off that way. But all of a sudden, there's a full-fledged military history of these battles and what's going on land. And that to me, made the book interesting throughout, because it wasn't kind of the same thing for 500 pages. It's a big book.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like multiple books at one in one place, and a shifting theme from kind of political history with Vichy and everything to full-fledged spies to full-fledged military history as you move forward.
Well, everything sort of telegraphs at the beginning. Like, we have this notion of resistance and collaboration and Vichy and the spies, and everything sort of telegraphs right into Torch. Mm-hmm. And sort of all the pieces are put in place, and then Torch sort of unfurls. And for those that operate, we haven't really said this, but Operation Torch, November 8th, 1942, the invasion starts. So thank you.
So once the ground forces arrive, the role of OSS and those who had been working with the resistance essentially disappear. I mean,
it does, yeah.
King's work, he's been spending years at this point,
right,
establishing relationship with the resistance, establishing who are the people we should be dealing with, who are the collaborators, and the work is completely ignored.
They get called off because when... So 4 hours before the Americans are supposed to come ashore, we talked... Antoine Barthoir, who we talked about before, the head of the Casablanca Division, goes and visits Charles Nogas, who's the resident general, and says, you should surrender. The Americans are off the shore. You know, they're coming ashore. You don't want to fight. This is a good chance for you to be on the right side of history. As he was doing that, they were concerned that the plans laid by the resistance would interfere with Bethuart's work, but that also potentially Americans. So they call off the resistance in Casablanca. That, unlike in Algiers, which is actually the resistance in Algiers is key to taking the city in less than a day. But they get called off. And so King kind of finds himself, along with Reed, stuck in the U.S. consulate, where they are under siege, and there's an attempt made to take them out to the desert and imprison them. King manages to escape before he has to get on the bus with everybody else, and sort of goes barreling around with some of his resistance buddies to try and hook up with the Americans. But one of the problems that happens for OSS is that they've done all this work and they know all these people, but once the army arrives, the army doesn't know what to do with them. And so you see a lot of that work evaporate, and they're not interested in knowing who's a collaborator and who
isn't.
It's like
Patton doesn't care,
yeah, in part because Patton's happy to let Nogas just continue. So even after the Americans come, Charles Nogas, who's been running French Morocco, is allowed to continue on as resident general, partly because we did not show up with enough men to occupy the country and completely replace the administration. So we kind of had to go along with what was going on. And Patton is content to just let Nogas run the country the best way he knows how.
And that goes against his orders, because Eisenhower,
yes,
he basically had to make a command decision on the spot.
Yeah.
And it's one that perhaps others should have made later on, of this is not an occupying force. We're going to let the locals continue to occupy their own area, and locals meaning Vichy French. Right.
So that means that Bethuart's arrested. And he's Dave King has to basically go in and save him. There was a trial that was about to take place, and he would have been executed.
Which is extraordinary. Again, I'm almost like laughing at this sardonically. The idea is that the Americans are there. They've captured the territory, and yet the people who have been collaborating with the Germans are arresting the resistance members who are collaborating with the United States.
Yes.
All under our noses. And you take, if Dave King hadn't done something about it, they may have executed somebody who had been working with the United States literally as the U.S. forces are standing there watching.
Yes. It's incredibly frustrating, and very Dave King gets very angry, and it's one of the reasons he ends up leaving Casablanca. Because they're basically spending time trying to get their resistance contacts out of jail. And, meanwhile, they're being constantly arrested. They're going around and arresting people.
Which is a kind of a hint or a preamble to the insanely frustrating post-invasion politics between de Gaulle and everybody else that you do a great job going into. I'm going to let people read it because I don't even want to talk about it. It is so confusing and annoying and frustrating. It makes you hate. If you hated de Gaulle before, you're going to hate him more, but you're going to hate everybody else too.
It's a very it's an incredibly frustrating period, and I think that's one of the reasons that we don't talk about North Africa the way that, say, we talk about other parts of the war, because it is so messy, and it's just morally sort of, it's vague and murky, and there, it's so much gray, and there's not a lot of black and white.
Well, and it's so different than the conquering, geez, Vince, yes, of Japan and Germany, because we had absolute power to do anything that we wanted to there. But we needed the French in North Africa because we didn't have the capability of doing the day-to-day.
Right. We needed the mythical 100,000 troops that were supposedly ready to go that turns out they weren't quite ready to go, but we ended up providing material and training for.
So let me wrap this up by asking, you kind of started with this, I'll end with it also, is how much, you know, when we, as historians, when we watch movies about our particular period, for, you know, for me, whenever I watch a movie on intelligence or a movie on nuclear weapons, it's hard for me not to be nitpicky. How much has this ruined the movie Casablanca for you? I mean, are there elements of truth in that?
You know, it hasn't. Yeah. Because Casablanca, the movie itself, yes, there's a love story, but it's also about making decisions about what side are you on? Do you resist? Do you collaborate? And that is the whole entire story of North Africa is, you know, where is your line? What is the line that you won't cross before you decide that you can't do X or Y or Z? And it hasn't ruined it. Also, Casablanca gets a lot of stuff wrong, but it gets a lot of stuff right. Like the struggle of the refugees to get out, and how difficult it was, and how important visas are. That's absolutely true. You know, it doesn't get other. There are other things that it gets wrong. And if you love the movie, you can stop here. No, but it doesn't. You know, it doesn't. You know, Rick is a incredibly extraordinary. Would have been a very extraordinary character because before the Americans arrived with 33,000 men in November 1942, there were only 100 Americans in all of Morocco. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Rick would have been extraordinary. But it hasn't ruined it for me. I'm not an obsessive. I have not watched it as many times as people think.
But at its heart, it kind of gets the basics right. I mean, the idea of kind of... And that really does come across in the book, this idea of who can you trust, who are the collaborators, you know, everyone has multiple loyalties and kind of you never know who's deceiving whom.
Yes.
Which really does come across not only in the movie but also in real life. Yeah, so of all the podcasts and all the museums in the world, Meredith Henley walked into mine. She is the author of Destination Casablanca, Exile, Espionage, and the Battle for North Africa in World War II. Don't get thrown off by the size of this book. It is well worth the read. And like I said, you can even break it up into pieces because it goes from a great World War II era political history to a nice little spy history to a full-fledged military history. So thank you for taking the time to join us here today.
Thank you for having me.
We truly appreciate it.